There is a Ramana Maharshi quotation, to see God is to be God. This sums up the teaching of Advaita. So when we see everyone in our life is an instrument of the same creator, and that includes all we love and hate, then we are seeing God in everyone. Now, what does this mean? To see God is to be God. You can only have a sense of neutrality towards everyone in your life when you grant people their beingness. You allow people to be the way God created them without trying to change them or wishing they were made another way. So if you grant people their beingness, that grant of beingness can take place only from your beingness, because you have set aside your views and opinions about people and how they should behave and should not behave and how they should be and should not be. So you are approaching people with your own beingness, not with your mind, which has been conditioned since you were a small child, and that mind which has split your world into the polarities of love and hate and all permutations in between. Hating someone but not as much as hating someone else. Loving someone but not loving them as much as someone else. And so we have put people in the scale between the polarities of love and hate, and we live our life like this. But when we see God in those we like and do not like, in those we love and do not love, we are out of this matrix of duality. Otherwise, till our last breath, our consciousness is split between love and hate. If I view people as an individual with my own set of conditionings and views, I will live the individual life. But if I start seeing this wondrous variety of God's creation, which includes myself, there is an acceptance of the other and myself. I start accepting whatever my limitations are, were not placed there by myself. So I'm less harsh on myself. I didn't create my conditioning. I had no control as a child over how my parents treated me, the amount of money they had, the religion they belonged to, and so on and so forth. And this made me become who I am. And then I thought my view was the right view. I lost sight of the fact that my view is my view. Someone else's view is their view. So this constant need to prove myself to be right started developing, and the world to be wrong, and life became a battle. So to see God is to be God means to understand that the same consciousness functions through everyone, through all instruments designed by the one source consciousness. Yet, I have to navigate my life. I have to deal with people. But with this understanding, I am not fighting battles with people. I am tackling the situation. I see through people, especially those who are mean to me, because now the understanding is that they are actually suffering. And the meanness is an expression of their suffering. But we take it personally because we are the receiving end. That is what happened. People are expressions and sum totals of their life experience. If we just allow them to be that, we start getting comfortable with them. We start getting comfortable with them. We start getting comfortable with ourselves. This is the ultimate healing. It is a healed consciousness. Not a consciousness of dis-ease. It is a consciousness at ease with God's creation, with life, because I know that life is pleasure and pain. When I sleep well at night, I don't thank God for a good night's sleep, but when I don't sleep, I have a complaint. I didn't sleep well. Isn't that arrogance? But when I accept the dualistic nature of life and living, I am ready to face life. I start facing life rather than escaping from situations, escaping from people, escaping from myself, We escape from ourselves by getting addicted to things. But when I turn around and realize no more, because this is not working, then I'm ready to face life. That is the start of the spiritual journey. It is everyone's experience that whatever we try and escape from comes running after us, because the lesson has to be learned. So what we speak about, we say, is peace of mind in daily living. Because you may have the highest experiences of samadhi, but your daily living might still be a mess. So we keep it very simple, deceptively simple. But actually, what is happening is the dissolving of the thinking mind. It is a grand deception, because what is happening is the teaching is pushing you into the self, but holding your hand so you don't feel bad about it. Because nobody wants to be told that they are irrelevant and that they don't exist. The ego does not like it. So here the teaching holds the ego's hand and says, hey, look at your reactions to life, look at your reactions to people, understand them. And by it is putting you into witnessing, sakshi bhav. So rather than jumping into this rough and tumble of life and situations and what people said and what they did and what I said, what I did and so on, I am witnessing what is arising in the moment. That is a quality of the self, not of the mind. When I find my thinking mind is more and more silent, because there's no garbage anymore. The garbage is mainly could, would and should, living in the dead past or an imaginary future. When I start living in the present moment, being available for whatever arises, for whoever comes before me, honoring that, then that is a quality of the self, the one self. So this teaching is moving you back to that beingness, that self. But we don't use those words, because then it seems like something to attain. When you keep it simple, peace of mind in daily living, it's something one can work with. Sukha Shanti, happiness of peace, not happiness which depends on something in life. I feel happy when someone says something nice to me, and when they are mean to me, I feel sad. Happy, sad, happy, sad. Is this life worth living? But that happiness of peace, that is called true happiness, which does not depend on anything or anyone. Another word for it is ananda. Ananda actually translates as deep contentment, not bliss. Deep contentment. So whatever is troubling us in life, our core issues, our pain points, these are our teachers. It is an invitation by them to look at the pain which is within. And the more we are not at peace, the more troubled we are, reveals to us that by and large, ours is a life of psychological suffering. And that suffering is the suffering of what will happen to me. I lose money, what will happen to me? I lose a loved one, what will happen to me? How will I survive? And so on and so forth. That me which is afraid of death, the me was designed that way. The child was pure being, had no concept of death, but that child developed an ego, not by the child's will, by the design of duality. And me and the other became me versus the other. That is the Maya, the illusion of separation. The child has no sense of separation. The child is incapable of judging someone, whether that person is deemed to be physically beautiful or ugly. The child has no concept of these things, because the child is an expression of pure being. And then the ego starts developing. It is given a name, the parents force the child to respond to the name, and then starts doership. Don't do this, do that. And the child thinks, I'm actually doing things. Earlier, there was no concept of doership. And then the birth of doership happens. And all the troubles come up. The sage knows that the primal doer is God, appearing as everyone. That is the only difference. So the sage does not carry resentments to the grave, hatred to the grave. Because for the sage, it is finished. He here and now it's finished. People are absorbed of the sense of doership. So in that sense, the sage is out of the illusion of separation. The illusion is an illusion of separation. The one source consciousness has manifested as multiplicity, but not apart from itself, because if it was apart from God, that means they are two. Can anything be apart from God? If God is all-powerful, all-knowing, all-pervading, nothing can be apart from it, which means the reflection of the source is not apart from it. Imagine if God stood before a mirror and it considered the reflection apart from it. It doesn't make sense. God will have the realization, this is my reflection. It is all me. That is why when they say this world is an illusion, what they actually mean is it is an appearance. Illusion is real while you're here. You're part of it. But what happens is we take this to be the reality, the multiplicity to be the reality, losing sight of the fact that it is an appearance on the screen of consciousness. When we go to a cinema hall, watch a movie, we know we are watching a movie. We don't get so lost in the movie that we get identified with it and don't come out of it. That knowing the sage has, that this is the movie of life. There are different characters designed by the same source, playing out their roles on the screen of consciousness. Without that screen, I can't watch the movie. So simple. So when the ego is ready to die to its identifications, what it has identified with, that is the journey of spiritual wisdom. Nothing is as it seems. If I told you that what you're seeing right here, right now, is not individuals and not colors, but light waves, can you believe it? Impossible. People look so real. But science will tell you what you are seeing is light waves. A flower, you think you're seeing a purple flower, red flower, yellow flower. There is no color. It is a light wave hitting the eye, and the rate of vibration at which that wave hits the eye is interpreted as color through the eye. Can you see the grand deception? Light waves are hitting your eye and at different vibrations, which are interpreted by the eye as color. If we are told that if a big tree in the forest falls down and there is no sound, it's very hard to believe. While the tree is falling down, there is no sound. There is no sound. But because that falling creates a sound wave which hits the eardrum, because of the vibration of the wave, we human beings and other beings interpret it as sound. But the self is silent. That is the Maya. If you actually saw human beings as light bodies in front of you, you would not judge them. You see, because you're seeing the one light. It's fascinating. That is why Maharaj said, consider this life like a dream and be done with it. Consider this life like a dream and be done with it. The living dream of life, the dream of separation. Obviously, it can't be real because it disappears in deep sleep. How can reality disappear? What is real has to be real all the time, not sometimes. And here we go making out so many problems for ourselves, so many inharmonious relationships, so many things that perturb us, which we are so busy with throughout the day. And life is a life of inharmony and lack of peace because I'm lost in the living dream of life. When I wake up out of it, out of this dream, it seemed it never happened. Can you pass the mic? Does anyone have?
Baby is born, so the consciousness is born. Then with the naam, you give a name, then that gets the identification that is Anita or whoever the person. With the conditioning and life experiences, we grow up. So when do we get the spiritual wisdom that our whole mindset changes and we start seeing the oneness? Is there any stage? What leads to that?
As Ramana Maharshi said, setbacks. If not the first blow in life, then the second. If not the second, then the third. Eventually you start questioning, what is life about? What am I doing here? Is this life worth it? That is the birth of the spiritual journey, because you have realized that this is not giving you true satisfaction. So in 90% of the cases, it is setbacks which bring one to the path. And that setback is a loss. Loss of money, loss of fame, loss of wealth, loss of a person. You feel distraught. So you start wondering that, is this life worth living if the one I've loved has died? Because then everyone I love is going to die at some point. So that's a setback. So the ego realizes that this is the realm of loss. What is in it for me? Where can I find my peace in this uncertainty of life? That is the start of the spiritual journey. Now, some people may be on their own figuring this out, trying to make sense of things, while others for whom it's happened will be drawn to talks like this, or like any spiritual gatherings or whatever it be, any tradition, Kriya Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, based on their destiny, while yet others may be lost in life's suffering, but even this thought has not arisen, what is life about? And they live a life of unconscious suffering. The one on the spiritual path lives a life of conscious suffering because they are aware of their suffering, you see. The one who is on the spiritual journey is aware that my mind is disturbed, and probably I'm also disturbing other people's minds without knowing it. So it is a journey of awareness, but depending on each person's destiny, it will move according to a divine plan. That is why, whether it was Sai Baba of Shirdi or Ramakrishna, they would keep emphasizing being in the company of saints, being in satsang, because that satsang starts erasing the conditioning of the ego. That is what happened. So when it's like an ancient call to wake up, which makes me take that step, which so far I haven't taken, because I've been so consumed by life and suffering, that I come out. That step, it appears I am taking, but it is the source which has been so gracious that it's moved me in a certain direction. And that is why my teacher would say, anyone on the spiritual journey, never consider your glass half empty, consider it half full. Because if God has brought you here, why do you think He'll drop you here? This much God has brought you. You may think you read a book, you did this, someone told you that, you've landed up at a place like this or any place, XYZ. But it is that same source which has moved you in a certain direction so that this unraveling of your suffering starts happening. Can we reduce the fan speed of the AC?
I have two questions. Let's say I have a desire which has arisen in my mind. Okay. There is a desire which has arose and I am aware of it. But so since I'm aware, I don't act it out. But I play imaginary situations in my mind. Is that same? Like, is it equal?
Depends on the desire. Now, for example, if in my mind the desire arises to have a cup of mint tea at the CCI club, I will go and try to fulfill the desire. I will not play it out in my mind. So can I see the execution of the desire? So I try my best. But if I go there and they say we've run out of mint, so be it. Thy will be done. The desire arose to have mint tea. Ma'am, you're dropping a lot of things. It's a good sign. It's a good sign to drop things at satsang. I said it's a good sign to drop things at satsang. Yeah. So it depends. See, we are in the realm, in the human realm, it is natural to have desire. And all I can do is try to fulfill the desire.
If I know that there is a consequence,
I have to use my buddhi. You may have what is classified as an impure desire. Be aware that you may have to face the consequences of your actions. Simple. Inner sage desires arise, but the sage will not pursue that desire to the detriment of his peace of mind and the other's peace of mind. The sage will see the desire arising, will see what can be done to fulfill it, and leave the rest to God. And the second question?
So let's say a newborn child is born. Let's say I decide to give birth to a child. Now I know about this teaching. How then should I condition the child?
Exactly as you think and feel you should. But if an aware parent gives birth to a child, then that parent will not impose their views and will on the child beyond a point. They will allow the child to flourish. They will allow the natural inclinations of the child to take birth and be a guide to the child. What happens is unconscious parenting, you bombard the child with your views and your attitude towards others. For example, if your life has been a life of struggle as a parent, you are going to condition your child that way, telling the child your life will be a life of struggle. That is unconscious parenting. It's a bombardment of conditioning.
Can we remind the child of the oneness in any ways?
No child needs to be reminded of oneness. The adult needs to be reminded. That is the whole problem. We have to keep reminding ourselves. That is why they say that one enlightened being affects seven prior generations of the family. The repercussion goes backwards. That's what you're saying, child and parent. So when that adult reaches a stage of enlightenment and awakening, then it has tremendous repercussions. It sets free generations of doership. See, people say, why does this teaching expressed by this parampara make such a big deal of doership? But then you must question Lord Krishna, because the whole pivot of the Bible is the ego deluded thinks I am the doer. You pull that out, the Gita will fall. It is the foundation of our core spiritual scriptures, the sense of doership. So it's one thing to go attend Gita classes, excellent, but to bring it into daily living, the characters in your life and yourself, that is the sadhana, which gets missed by many people. Because then what happens, you'll go for a Gita class, after the class is over, you're down gossiping and bitching about someone whom you're jealous of because you don't have what they have. What kind of Gita class have you attended? So this is a very real living teaching. I'm really trying to discover the demons in my head and release them. That is what is happening.
Thank you.
Yes, Padmini.
So just to follow up on her point about her question about the child and conditioning and how should I condition? And you said, don't condition, step back, allow the child to flourish. Isn't that, or would you say that's also a doership of a sort?
Of course.
Do not do.
Yes.
Yeah.
Everything is doership.
Huh.
But when we feel we know God's plan better than God, that is where the problem arises. So for example, a child is born and intuitively uses the left hand and is forced to use the right hand by the parent. Then that is where intrusion takes place. So now all children's first gurus are the parents. The child cannot survive without the parent. So in our scriptures also, it is everyone's parents are their guru first. But in the realm of doership, the aware parent will be very mindful of this. That just because God gifted me certain life experiences does not mean I have to subject my child to the same. Then what happens is that child starts hating the parent. That's what happened.
That's also non-doing is also doing in a sense, isn't it? I'm not getting that part.
It is an allowing.
Hmm.
It is an allowing.
Which is doing also.
You could say that, but in terms of your expression in daily living, how would it unfold? Let's take any situation in your life or person in your life you are unhappy with. Anyone.
As we all are, I'm sure.
Yes. But the difference is, when you start accepting that this person is playing out their blueprint, their script, based on their destiny, then you start looking at them in another way. That is what happens. So you have absolved them of being the doers of their actions. Till now you were blaming and condemning them and hating them. But when you see that they are playing out their destiny, their script, you happen to be at the receiving end, then there's a shift in perspective because you're allowing them to be as they are. And because your conditioning was so hardwired against that person that you developed so many judgments about them, now you set them aside. So that is what starts happening. That is what is referred to as doership. I still have to tell that person something, but the quality of my words change, my actions change. Earlier, I would carry that hurt in my heart for a long time. Now I release it. Then I am absolved of doership. That is what it means. I still have to do. I still have to go with a friend to a restaurant. So I have to decide, do I go to this restaurant or that restaurant? Doership. You're in the realm of duality. You have to make a decision. Decision means doing. But now I know that I may choose a restaurant and not have a good experience, which is not in my control. So I am no longer guilty. I don't take the blame and tell my friend, oh, I'm sorry, I chose it. I should not have. If I had not had this experience, would not have happened. You would not have had this bad meal and so on. That is doership. When I am absolved of that, that one had to be chosen, I chose one based on my experience, my taste. It didn't turn out the way it was meant to. I'm absolved of doership. That is what starts. It's a very big thing because the ego loves guilt and shame and pride and arrogance. But these are shown the back door now. Because if you're not the doer, you cannot be proud or arrogant or guilty or shameful.
There's the second part of your answer where you said, if I may, about an enlightened being affecting several generations and healing several generations before the being. If you could please, just explain that, because...
But let's not get into that. Let's talk about our peace of mind. Okay.
Because that, I'm just asking that this, just quickly one point, don't answer it, that my understanding of ancestral healing, what they say is there's somebody there, many souls or incarnations before, who performed something or had an inclination which has distilled down through the gene or through that habit.
Yes,
through
that, absolutely.
Rather than go back upwards.
So doesn't this prove you're not the doer?
Okay.
Imagine if you're carrying an ancestral gene, like schizophrenia is genetic. That's what I've been told by therapists. You're not the doer. You've been programmed and designed with that gene, you see. So when we start living this understanding, then transformation starts. And forget ancestors. Is ours a healing presence or not? You know, it was Lester Levinson who said that the quality of your surroundings is a reflection of the quality of your consciousness. It's as simple as that. Is there strife, conflict, and more people who don't like you than who like you in your life? Because that's a reflection of your consciousness. This is all within one's consciousness, this play. And that healing is a healing of one's consciousness. You know, there's that famous saying I read that there are people who say that the year is almost over. I'm really sorry if I haven't offended you. I'll soon come to offend you. That is how we live our lives. On the offensive. That don't worry, wait, I'll come. You got me, so I'm going to get you. I'll wait for the right time.
So in the mornings, way, way before sunrise when I get up, I have started a practice for the last 5-6 months where some kind of positive affirmation, not from external sources, something that arises in my mind. That's a positive affirmation for the morning, for the day. So I had read somewhere, very interesting thing, that one of the affirmations is, I hereby willingly drop what no longer serves me. First thing, I didn't write it down immediately because I was wondering whether I was being selfish when the word I read serves me. Hmm. So then for a couple of weeks, I dwelled on this serves me. Like I took it in the other sense that I am some sort of such a special guy that what doesn't serve me anymore, I drop it.
What doesn't serve my ego?
No, But there's a finer tuning to what I realized a couple of weeks later, yes, what this expression meant. Because, yes, initially I felt that what doesn't serve my ego, I just drop it. So, reflecting on it, just wrote it on the side of the book, not on the main positive affirmations I read every morning. So, then I sort of comprehended that what longer no longer serves me, can it also possibly mean that does not serve my goal of peace of mind in daily living?
You could say that. Or you could say serves me is with the M caps, which is not me, the ego.
Not
but
the ego.
God, consciousness, the source,
God,
which is peace.
God wants, God's picture for all of us would be ideally the peace of mind in daily living.
Yes.
So if I realize a couple of weeks while dwelling on this topic, that what no longer serves me, who's me? I'm not me. My goal is peace of mind. So I equated that this does not serve me anymore, does not serve my goal of peace of mind.
Absolutely right.
So then I took a very, I'm saying it openly, you know my situation vis-a-vis my elder brother.
Mm.
So I took it easy. I reflected on it for 3 or 4 days, maybe a week. And he was bombarding me with emails over some claim of some business claims. I ignored. I wrote a one-line email back. As far as I am concerned, you don't exist. And I followed that very nicely for 3-4 months. He's out of the system.
But what does it mean you don't exist?
You don't exist for me in the sense, you don't affect me, your emails, I'm really saying he doesn't exist. He's there, I know he's there, he may be there, but I don't know if he's there. That's what I'm saying. I don't know if he's there or not. He may be there, may not be there. But I'm living my thought process in a very weird format that you don't exist for me.
But
successfully applied, successfully applied.
But you don't exist
in my consciousness.
How can it be?
No, because I've cut off all communication. Even my
that
thought
is
process
physically.
My thought process communication I've cut off. At the golf club we cross paths, I don't know, and somebody tells me your brother's sitting there. I said, Acha, okay. It's actually happening that way for a couple of months now. I've just pulled him out and he's out.
No, but the teaching is you do exist as an aspect of God.
No, as an aspect of God, but then I come back to my.
This is what you are describing as blocking.
Yeah, like on WhatsApp, he's blocked.
Exactly.
He's blocked.
I believe there's a word for it when girlfriends block boyfriends, ghosting or something they call it, right? You ghosted him.
I ghosted, posted, and roasted. Everything. Finished. See, it's just, as long as he was in my system, in my thought process, no other system, in my thought process, he would do something successfully.
I understand.
After ignoring him for years.
I understand.
All that cup of tea, pudina tea at Glockon Club, all dead. It was a waste of time. He would do something to get into my skin.
See,
so this,
as long as you have absolved him of the sense of doership, and
yes,
accepted him,
yes,
as an instrument of the divine. I have no ill will towards him.
No ill will.
Right?
I wish him well.
But tomorrow, if he approaches you for some help, would you give it?
No.
So that has to be looked at.
And I won't go to him. If I'm in trouble, I won't go to him for help.
Because you have choices. If someone does not have a choice, what will they do?
I know he doesn't have a choice.
So you see, this
is
actually...
It's not being selfish. It's not even doership, I feel. I'm a little confused, hence this dialogue. See, I thought I would make amends. I mentioned on that couch that we have a cup of tea together. Massive failure. I opened a door,
maybe
many doors
so
for him to approach.
I understand this fully, what you're saying.
I opened too many doors for him.
Because sometimes the Rinanubandhan is like that. That you just come together and there's an explosion.
Yes.
I understand that.
But
yet, there is no finality as far as a sage is concerned.
Not a finality. I wouldn't say I'm a sage also, and there's no finality.
But it's sounding like a finality. I understand what you're saying, because there are some people in your life who you don't want to cross their path.
Yes.
But this thing of they don't exist for me is blocking out an aspect of God. There's a famous story of Sai Baba. Someone had come to see him and they heard a frog croaking very loudly. And that man ran outside to see, and a snake had got it in its mouth. And Sai Baba also went outside and he called them by their names. Some Busappa and Veerbrada, stop it. I don't remember the names. And then that frog is let go of by the snake and the snake runs away. And this man asked Sai Baba, what the hell was that, you know? And he said, these two have been at it since past births, one trying to kill the other. And same thing happened here. And this was this one's name, that one was that one's name. This is what we are doing. The seven generations go like this only. You keep coming back. That is why they say that the murderer and the murdered have a pact. And they keep coming back and changing the roles. Doership. It does not mean you have to forcefully meet that person and engage.
That's what I wanted to hear.
I'm not saying that. But see, this kind of contemplation is the spiritual journey. Analyzing, asking questions, wondering about life. That is the sadhana. It is being applied to daily living. You're not pondering some deep truth written in a scripture and trying to give your own gyan and views about it at a book club or something. This is it. What is troubling me? Why is it troubling me? What can I look at? What does it reveal to me? That is the sadhana. And the simplicity of life, which was so complex earlier, the beauty of how simple life is when it is seen through this prism, that all there is the one source, and the simplicity of knowing the peace of deep sleep, that no matter how much troubled I am in the day, God has gifted me deep sleep, which basically means the absence of me and my story, as proof that what disturbs you in the waking state is you and your story, and that is not that you're at peace. That is a gift we have not earned, the peace of deep sleep, but it's still given to us. But that peace of deep sleep, the sage has in the waking state. I mean, imagine a scenario where at the end of your life, all those who loved you and all those who troubled you, you're all together, and you're shaking hands with your brother. Oh, you played a fantastic role. Congratulations. Oh, you played a lovely role. If we do that now, within our consciousness, then the game is up. Then the game is up. You know, they say in our scriptures, stay close to the guru so that you cross through the samsara. What does it mean? The guru is consciousness, the source. So the more and more one is established in the source, in consciousness, in beingness, which is an expression of the source, one is close to the guru. The guru is the giver of light. Darkness is the darkness of the ego. So being close to the guru means that. When Maharaj said, those who stay on the earth will experience days and nights, but those who live on the sun will experience no darkness. What does he mean? The light of consciousness, gyan, and on the earth, day and night means duality, polaric opposites. So his invitation was to stay on the sun, means in the knowledge, with a capital K.
So once you said like you always mention that all there is one consciousness, and the consciousness cannot have conspiracy against itself. Like, even if one sits with that, like, you know, really contemplate and just sink with that, I feel then we might not have enemies.
Consciousness cannot hate itself.
Exactly.
If there is only one consciousness.
Exactly.
So this hate is the ego.
Exactly.
With a sense of separation and doership. How can... The nature of consciousness is love, because consciousness is all there is.
And because of mind, we see so many polarities and the assumption that there is someone apart from me.
Yes, exactly.
So I was just saying, like, you know, just sitting and deep contemplation, and if really this understanding goes within our veins and blood, I think so life will be wonderful.
And this is fresh conditioning. Mm-hmm. See, so far one lives one life a certain way, and then one comes across something which says, hey, just relook at your life, relook at things. That is fresh conditioning being infused, which over time overrides the old conditioning. We are conditioned beings, make no mistake. And sometimes old conditioning is very hard and crusty. So we are suffering that. Sometimes it's soft. So it's easier to come out of it, depending on one's prarabdha. Yes, that poor child has no idea. I keep giving that example, that child running around the house, if it drops some curio or vase and it shatters to the ground, the parent instinctive reaction is, don't do that. Stop running like that. The poor child, which is a pure expression of being, has been accused and convicted of doership. That is the birth of doership. Then the child is scared. What should I do? What I should not do? The fear of doership has got ingrained in the child. Be a good girl, be a good boy, don't do this, don't do that. And khatam, my suffering begins. Amazing. Yes, Rupal.
So, yesterday when I was contemplating, I was working on the Sedona method of Lester Levinson only. And I was contemplating all is one. And today the lecture of all is one happens. One thing which I realized reading Lester was that he said that going all the way, we are going for the complete freedom. And there I realized that if we have that referral goals, which are bigger than thing, and you have a higher goal of what you want to achieve, then letting go of all the other feelings becomes easier and easier. Like, and when you have that thing, like, you want to experience those type of an higher consciousness, the peace and everything. And if that peace is something which is most valuable to you, then letting go of everything else, whether your attachment or aversions, becomes far easier.
And, yes, sure.
And when I learned one thing about this, about the aversions, were that it's very difficult to accept some person who has done something to you. But the greatest thing is that if you are into that quiet, peaceful equanimity stage and you want to be there and you want to cultivate that, then it becomes very easier for forgiving things, letting it go. Like my mother thing, because she has Alzheimer. So I have to accept the fact that she has Alzheimer. She will have this thing. Now that was her sole plan, to have that suffering. What I can do is that I can provide treatment. That's the first thing, or whatever I get. And I can pray for her soul.
Yes.
These are two things which I do. So then I have met peace now when I accepted this.
Correct.
And with all other people in my life, what I'm trying to do now is that every day in the office, whatever happens, I look at it and release that thing.
You know, people celebrate New Year's Eve, but I say each year is the same. Pleasures, pains, you don't know what the next moment brings. So what are you exactly celebrating? Unless you're celebrating that you have to live one less year on the planet. Which I doubt people are celebrating that. It is very beautiful, this exploration, the spiritual exploration. Really, it is like a drug, you know. Just once it's that fire is lit, it consumes everything. That is why Maharaj said, be very careful when you start the spiritual journey, because it can burn your house down. And by house, he means all your cherished beliefs, concepts, relationships, everything. But that is why we are in the Mrityu Lok. People forget this. This is the realm of death, the loka of death. And death is the death of the me and the mind. There we have incarnated to learn these lessons.
Namaste, Gautam. Namaste to all. I've been coming here and listening to you. And to continue this conversation, we obviously, all of us have those one or many people in our lives. So after listening to you and coming here, today a thought came to me that is it not an act of love that God is showing me an unhealed part of myself? And
my non-doership in this will be to surrender to God, that if you are calling me, if you are calling me home, and if you are giving me the unconditional love, then you will show, you will heal it. Like, why? Like, there's no need to do anything but to say thank you that you that person mirrored the unhealed part of my consciousness to myself.
Beautiful. And that wasn't my doing either. An unhealed part of my consciousness was not my doing.
And
God was revealing to God the unhealed part of consciousness. That is what made Lester Levinson, Joel Goldsmith say, once he was pretty through with his spiritual journey, that there were some people in his life he could simply not love. Everything else was perfect in terms of spiritual understanding and healing, but some people he could simply not love. And at that point, the thought arose that, look here, God, I can't love them, so you love them through me. That is the surrender.
So that actually, I can't, like when you say that you have to be in the company of saints and in the satsang, that is, I feel that I have got here because of this satsang and certain other spiritual practices, and this is pretty much my support, the boat that may take me through. But I guess that is grace. I mean, he has, obviously, it may not be my ego. This dependency may not be my ego. That is, I have to accept the grace that I am where I am today.
It is speaking. Only grace. And satsang means what? Satsang is the company of truth. That's the literal translation. What you're seeing is just an appearance of it. The ego is drawn to satsang, means it's had enough of itself, of the me, and now is drawn to truth. The me you can go and parade in your kitty parties and social gatherings, but that ego has had enough of all that, no longer derives its sense of self from that, and is drawn to the company of sat. That is satsang. That is grace. Any movement towards the self, the one self, is grace only, because self is drawing itself to itself. That is the import of satsang.
My sadhana, what you said to me, that the conscious, unhealed of consciousness is reflecting itself to itself, that is really, I'm going to hold it in my heart now. Thank you.
Hi, Gautam. I've been following your discourses for about a year now, and this is the first time I'm coming here. Over time, as I listened to you, it was clear that it's the mind which tries to understand what you say. And it is also the same mind which differentiates. So, and that leads you to a point where you think that it is beyond the mind's doing to sort of merge with consciousness. At the end of the day, like Vedanta says, that you're already that. It's just that you have an error which makes you feel that you're a separate body, you're a separate ego and people are different. And so you have your biases and you live your life the way you do. So the more that I think about it, it seems like I can use my brain to understand what you're saying. But it's the same brain which, 5 hours later will start differentiating between people again and which supports that ego. So, which makes me believe that it's a process which is outside thinking, which ultimately frees you and dissolves the ego. So it's not something that I understand, but the word which comes to mind is grace. That when it's time, when it's meant in your journey for the ego to dissolve, it will. And the only thing you can do is probably remain open.
True. And actually, you think it is your mind which has brought you here. I read something, I saw something, someone mentioned your name. But actually, it is the heart, because something appealed, otherwise you would not be here. The mind processes it later. That intuition, that feeling, because it could arise and you say, I don't want to be here. But something brought you here means at some level the heart is touched. Now the mind tries to make sense of it. That is a process. That is why the famous saying, your head is already in the tiger's mouth. Once you're in it, you're in it. There's no going back. That is a great relief. There's no going back to your old ways. That is it. There is no chance. You got fussed out.